Welcome to State of the Bay. I'm Grace Wan. Later on in the hour, we'll talk about whether students should have access to cell phones while they're in school. We'll be joined by San Mateo Superintendent Diego Ochoa, and Max Garoni, a San Francisco high school teacher and parent advocate, and we'll take your comments and calls. We'll also hear about a new San Francisco literary magazine hitting the shelves, Dreams I Dreamt, Letters to San Francisco. But first, when San Francisco voters head to the polls this November, they'll be faced with a ballot that uses ranked choice voting to elect local officials. It's a system that's meant to make running elections cheaper, but in the 20 years San Francisco has had this system, it's also made voting a little more strategic, with candidates often offering slates of who to rank first, second, and so on. It can be confusing, so here to help us understand how it works is Laura Wenis. She's a journalist based in San Francisco who focuses on local public policy and civic engagement. Welcome to State of the Bay, Laura.
Really glad to be here.
So let's start with the basics. With ranked choice voting, I can rank up to a certain number of candidates. I put them in order, 1, 2, 3, etc. After I do that, then what happens?
So the way that it works is you choose your favorite candidate, like you just said, you put them in choice number one and so on. And when your ballot gets to the Department of Elections, they start tallying. And if nobody gets more than 50% in that first round of tallying, someone, the person with the least number of first choice votes, is eliminated. That person's second and third and so on choice votes are allocated. So there's the second choice votes of the people who chose the eliminated candidate as their first. They get allocated to the different candidates that remain. And that happens over and over and over again with more and more people getting eliminated until you have somebody who gets more than 50%. This is sometimes known as instant runoff voting, kind of because it does what a runoff election would do, except on the same ballot. So you would be asked, you'd be asking yourself, if this candidate who I favor were not running in this race, who would I be voting for? And that's how they tally it up and how you ultimately get to a winner.
Well, what problem is ranked choice voting trying to solve? I mentioned that it makes elections a little less expensive because you don't have to have these runoffs later on. But yeah. What other problems is it trying to solve?
So you mentioned this term strategic. And actually, one of the ideas behind ranked choice voting is that it helps voters choose more sincerely rather than strategically. So you often hear in, let's say, the presidential election of the United States, this idea of, like, if you vote for a third party because a third party candidate is your actual, genuine, sincere favorite, then you're just handing the election victory to the other person that you don't want to win. This is a concept known as splitting the vote or splintering the vote. And ranked choice voting helps to mitigate that effect, if not eliminate it entirely, because you can vote sincerely. You can put your first choice as, you know, somebody who may not have a huge chance of winning. Mm-hmm. And when they get eliminated, mm-hmm. you still have a say in what happens after that.
But we only go to ranked choice if somebody doesn't get 50% of the vote.
Right.
So if somebody gets 50% plus one, mm-hmm. we don't even have to get to ranked choice voting.
Yep.
Yeah. And in a contest where there are multiple candidates, sometimes it's unlikely that we will get 50% for that one person.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah. So this is also a way to give people kind of a broader choice. And in theory, it's supposed to help or incentivize candidates to appeal to a broader base so that they have the support of people with, like, varying degrees of enthusiasm, and those people will still be counted. So if you're a candidate, you don't want to completely alienate the voters who might favor two other candidates more than you, because if those two are eliminated, you still want those voters to think that you're a viable choice. You do not want to be somebody's anyone but that person vote.
But that can happen.
It can happen that people strategize around this idea of, like, vote for anybody except for this one person. And we're seeing that emerge in San Francisco. Whether or not it will work is a different question, because you need to give people, if you're a candidate, a reason to vote for you as well as some of your opponents.
Mm. I mean, it's possible, too, that we were talking about whether this is strategic or not, that mm-hmm. you can, as a candidate, say, I contain all multitudes. I appeal to all things. But then when you're in office, you don't really do that. or maybe not, because you have ranked choice voting to look forward to, you know, in the next election.
You have to win in multiple ranked choice contests, perhaps, yes. Mm-hmm. I think this is really the idea here is you want to encourage more people to enter the race rather than discourage people from entering the race, because you have like somebody who, you know, has a base of support but is widely unpopular, and somebody who is more popular but, you know, risks losing if somebody closer to their side enters the race and steals some of their votes or splits the majority support, and then you end up with something called a plurality election. If somebody doesn't have majority support but has more than the other guys, mm-hmm. You can end up with that person winning in a plurality system. An example of this to illustrate what I'm talking about. There was a mayoral contest in a Missouri election, a mayoral election. Sorry, I don't know the details right now. So it was this crazy story of a Fall River, I believe, mayor who was indicted and then recalled with a majority of the electorate supporting the recall, mm-hmm. who entered the election to replace him.
Oh, wow.
And won because a plurality system.
Oh, that makes everybody unhappy.
Because he had the most votes, even though he didn't get a majority, because there were many candidates.
Right, right. Well, let's talk about the local impact here. I think that most of the Bay Area races, well, particularly in San Francisco, will be ranked choice. I've got the mayor, the city attorney, the DA, the public defender, sheriff, treasurer, assessor, and the board of supervisors. That's all ranked choice,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
Voters are going to really have to do some homework here to figure out, even if the candidates don't have a strategy, voters are going to need to have a strategy going in, right?
Well, I will tell you this. If you're a San Francisco voter with a little bit of fatigue, you don't have to.
Oh.
Your vote is still counted even if you only rank one person.
Oh, that's nice to know.
Yes. And we in San Francisco are lucky enough to get up to 10 choices.
Ah.
That does not mean you get to vote 10 times. You cannot vote for the same person in choice 1 through 10.
Oh, I see.
Then if you do that, your vote will still be counted, but only in that first category. You don't get to vote multiple times in the same election. You essentially get to vote in multiple elections in one go.
So even though I get 10 choices, there are 13. Let's talk the mayor's race. There are 13 people running for mayor. Mm-hmm. I can rank 10 of the 13 candidates, mm-hmm. but I don't have to rank all 10, right? Mm-hmm. I could stop at 3. It just means that my ballot will stop being counted after the third person I ranked.
Yeah, you're essentially saying, okay, if none of these three make it in, I leave it up to the rest of you guys. Mm-hmm. You can decide without me. I don't want to do all this research. I can't rank them all in order.
Well, I've lived in San Francisco for a while, and I've seen where in past years candidates will get together and say, vote for one of us, one or two.
Yes.
We're going in as a team. I think we saw that with Jane Kim and Mark Leno in 2018. Mm-hmm. Do you anticipate that happening this time around, where a Daniel Lurie and a Asha Safai will say, make us a 1-2 choice?
So far, I have not seen that happen. And I think there are a number of reasons why. First of all, you have multiple moderate candidates. That would be actually a good reason for them to develop a ranked choice strategy, is to say, this other person is actually quite similar to me. And if they don't win and you favor them, you might consider voting for me in your second or third place. That would make sense. But I think there's a little bit of a challenge here in that most of the top four contenders who are not incumbent, who are not the incumbent, have basically had this message of the incumbent has failed at her job, so you should vote for me instead. They seem to be courting primarily first choice votes. So when you're saying the incumbent has failed, you're unlikely, I would say, to attract fans of Mayor London Breed to vote for you second. Maybe. Mm. I don't know. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, it depends on how voters feel about that and how, like, enthusiastic they are about the mayor. But I think that presents a sort of challenge right off the bat to any kind of messaging along the lines of, you know, we're actually quite aligned.
Mm-hmm.
If you're presenting yourself as the polar opposite, that may be challenging. As we talked about earlier, you know, or alluded to earlier, there is already a little bit of a sentiment of, like, anybody but the progressive, anybody but Peskin, which is what some of the moderate supporters are saying. Again, I don't know how much overlap there's going to be between, you know, Peskin supporters and, I don't know, Farrell supporters, for example. I don't know how many Peskin supporters would put Farrell as their number two. But there are a lot of candidates. And maybe there are some folks who you want to appeal to if you are a moderate candidate and you think that you can win over on certain issues progressive voters.
Well, we've had the chance, or I particularly have had the chance, to interview each of the five top mayoral candidates. And I did ask them what their ranked choice strategy would be. And their ranked choice strategy boils down to put me number one.
Yeah. Well, that's not really a ranked choice strategy. So, you know, and that can be dangerous for candidates if they're mainly courting first choice votes and they don't think about the ranking strategy. They don't think about how voters are coming to this ballot being like, oh, man, I don't know who to put for number two, because then you may be losing out on people who might actually prefer you to somebody else, mm-hmm. but they didn't express that.
Mm. Do you think that candidates, instead of saying putting themselves in a coalition of vote us one, two, and three, are better off having a different organization do that for them? For example, a Together SF gives you a ballot. You know, around election time, we get these postcards that give us advice
right.
from various PACs
yeah.
or various special interests. I mean, do you think that's something that will happen this time and it takes the pressure off candidates?
Could be. Again, I think if you are running an aggressive campaign that positions yourself as the polar opposite of other candidates, or positions yourself as very far removed from other candidates, it may be difficult to then switch gears to a message that says, actually, I'm similar enough that you should put me second. How much voters are looking for that kind of signaling, I don't honestly know. I'm not a political analyst,
sure.
so I don't know that. And I also don't know how influential those voter guides ultimately are. I think with to get sort of more, you know, San Francisco inside politics with this, but, you know, with the DCCC elections and the last election, we did see that it seems like the Together SF voter guides were helpful to people. I mean, it looks like they were successful. But I don't know if that was the voter guide or if it was organizing or ground game
yeah.
or what. So it's a little hard to say whether that can be outsourced.
I was speaking to somebody over the weekend about this, and the ranked choice element, intellectually you understand, okay, this will mean that we don't have to have a runoff. But it does mean, gosh, I have to do a little homework and I'm getting a little nervous. You know, I want to do this right. I don't want my ballot invalidated.
Yeah.
So what I hear you saying is, as long as you choose someone, your ballot will be counted.
Choose someone and do not rank the different people at the same rank. So don't choose two different people in third place. Can't do that. You can't choose two different people in first place. That will not give them both one vote.
Mm-hmm.
You just have one vote in each column. Think of it as multiple elections on one ballot
right.
rather than you having multiple votes to allocate.
Yes, it's like ranking the flavors. You can't just say that, you know, strawberry is my favorite flavor, 1, 2, 3, and 4, right?
Right. That is not going to help your candidate get elected.
Well, there's more to be done here and to talk about, but I think has been a really excellent primer on ranked choice voting. Thanks so much for joining us, Laura Winnis.
Thanks for having me.
Great. Coming up next on State of the Bay, we'll talk to San Mateo's K-8 superintendent, Diego Ochoa, and then high school teacher and representative Max Garone. Stay tuned for more State of the Bay.
On Your Call, we talk about current events, politics, arts, and the media. We're always thinking about ways people can get involved and make change. And we want your knowledge and experience in the mix. I'm Rose Aguilar. Join the conversation on Your Call weekdays at 10 a.m. on KALW. Or make your voice heard anytime. Email us, yourcall@kalw.org, or tweet at Your Call Radio.
Hi, I'm Marissa Ortega-Welch, and I'm the host of KALW's new segment, Natural State. It features soundscapes from ecosystems all over California. It's a chance to slow down and listen up. Tune in every Wednesday at 7:15 a.m. and 3:45 p.m. Natural State. Only here on KALW San Francisco Bay Area.
Welcome back to State of the Bay. I'm Grace Wan. If you've ever tried to get a kid to put down a phone, imagine being a teacher with 30 children in your class, most of whom have access to a phone. It's tough. Currently, California lets school districts regulate cell phone use among students as they see fit. But a new bill is on the table that will require all schools in California, all public schools in California, to limit cell phone access at school. If you're wondering if that's even an achievable goal, newsflash, some Bay Area schools have already done this. They have cell phone bans in place. What can we learn from their successes? Well, here to discuss this policy, I am pleased to be joined by someone who's made it happen. He's the superintendent of San Mateo's Kindergarten through 8 School District, Diego Ochoa. Welcome to State of the Bay.
Hi, how are you?
Great. We're also pleased to be joined by Max Garone. He is a member of the San Francisco Parent Coalition Leadership Council and a high school teacher himself. Welcome to State of the Bay.
Thanks for having me.
Great. And we want you to be part of the conversation, listeners. If you're out there, are you a parent? Would you like to see phones kept outside the classroom? Or if you're a teacher or an educator, do you find cell phones helpful or hurtful in classrooms? And if there are any students out there listening to State of the Bay tonight, what's your vote? Would you like to keep your cell phone at home or with you at school? Give us a call on your cell phone. We're at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. You can find us on social media or email us at stateofthebay@kalw.org. I wanted to start with you, Superintendent. I mean, your school district made the decision to ban cell phones. Why?
You know, it goes back, if you can remember, coming out of the pandemic, we had kids on campus. They were in a hybrid mode, they called it, where some of the kids were at home, some of the kids were at school. In our district, we actually moved kids around all over the district. So it really didn't matter where you lived. You got assigned a school based on how many teachers we had at that place. We saw a tremendous, tremendous increase in the number of kids using their cell phones during class. And we had never seen that before the pandemic. Kids certainly had them. But I think it was just more common for them to keep them in their pocket or in their backpack. When they came back from the pandemic, they literally could not pull away from their phones. And we struggled with it the next year. We got to April of 2022, and we said, we've just got to put a stop to this. And we actually have a local high school, San Mateo High School. It's one of the high schools in the San Mateo Union High School District. And it's the only school in that district that has the cell phone policy where the kids have to put them away. So I sent a team of people out there to go see what they do. And we saw teenagers looking at each other and talking to each other and not staring down at their phones.
Well, how do they do it exactly? I mean, are the kids not allowed to bring phones at all?
They bring them. It's like a concert. If you've been to, you know, one of these places where they say put them in the gray pouches, we have, they're called Yonder pouches. Mm-hmm. We saw it firsthand and said, we are doing this at every middle school. And within 2 months, we had it in place at all of our middle schools. So for the start of the 22-23 school year, the new policy went into place and every single kid was assigned a pouch. And we have hundreds of extras in the main office just in case. And the kids just got used to them and started using them right away.
And do they not have access to them throughout the school day?
Or they can't open it.
Oh.
It's magnetized. So it looks a little bit like the piece that's on your jeans that you buy at the store that the employee has to take off with a little magnet. At the end of the day, we put magnets up all over campus and kids walk up and demagnetize the pouch and then the pouch opens up and they can use their phone.
And does the pouch stay at school or does the pouch?
It stays with the student. So kids just, we encourage them to put them in their backpacks.
Mm-hmm.
Some kids put them in their pocket.
Yeah. But
it stays with them at school. And I like it because it means they can use their phone up until the time they get to school. So they can text their folks and say, hey, I made it. Mm-hmm. So a lot of our kids ride the bus to school.
Mm-hmm.
And then as soon as school's out, they can use their phone, come pick me up. I'm on the corner. Where are you? That sort of thing. And it's really useful in that way.
I bet you some parents would like to have that Yonder pouch and magnet at their home, right?
They've asked us.
That's awesome. I mean, Max, you're in the studio with us, and you're nodding vigorously about this. I mean, tell me from a teacher's point of view, what is it like when you have a bunch of students in your classroom and everybody's kind of itching to look at their phones?
Well, I mean, it's really hard because everybody's always distracted. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's if you're trying to teach, you can't teach distracted kids, and if a kid is distracting themselves, they're distracting other people. And so it's a constant battle to work through that and around that. And then, as the superintendent was saying, too, there's a real trouble with kids just looking at their phones outside of class. And you would love them to be talking to people, to be doing something social or interacting with the environment in general. That's part of learning as well. And it's very difficult in a school situation where somebody is looking at videos constantly that, you know, it's a phone and everything on it has been built to distract people.
Yeah, I mean, we're hearing so much more about how bad social media is for all of us, but particularly kids. The U.S. Surgeon General, Vivek Murthy, has come out saying it's actually a health crisis. When you hear that, Max, does that resonate with what you're seeing in the classroom?
Oh, definitely. I mean, it's very much, you know, kids are obsessed with this because it's part of their social lives, but also it's been built to obsess them. And every little thing comes down to social media, sharing and distracting yourself and everybody around you. And then it can also get very dangerous. You know, people share things that they should not be sharing, and it can really be detrimental to a kid's self-esteem and also to the entire social system of a school. It can undermine it entirely. And so that's a really tricky thing to deal with as a teacher when there's no consistent implementation of a policy.
Well, we were curious. I think grown-ups will feel kind of the same way about this. Relatively, like, less phones is a good thing, although maybe we're not all the best models of that. But we did ask a bunch of students what they thought about cell phone bans. And here we have Precious, who has a comment about that.
Hi, my name is Precious. I just graduated from fifth grade from Pennycook Elementary. I'm just calling because I wanted to say I think phones shouldn't be allowed at school, because playing on the playground with your friends and living in the moment is more fun than playing on your phone, because you can have real conversations and not just text and hurt your fingers and stuff. Thank you. Goodbye.
Well, I mean, that was actually quite Precious from Precious. I mean, when you hear that, Superintendent, what do you think? I mean, here's Precious saying it's better to be in real life playing with your friends and you're not injuring your thumbs when you're texting. Does that just validate what you've seen?
It does. And I think, you know, all of us in this room, in some way, we interact with technology for work, on a personal level. And our teenagers are showing us how technology affects them. They're looking down at their phones. They're taking and I'm doing air quotes here, a bathroom pass so they can go use their phone in the restroom.
I think you've heard every excuse,
yeah.
Right,
Diego? What we don't see is what's happening inside. And what's happening inside for many, many teenagers is a tremendous anxiety based on what's happening on their phone all day long. The constant worry of who liked my picture, who sent me a message, who's reacting to what I put out there, who's not reacting. And that's what our teenagers tell us, is that they now have a time of the day where all that is deprioritized. It still may affect them after school, but during that beginning and end of school, they get a break from it. And I think it's a really healthy thing for them.
Well, your school district is kindergarten through eighth grade.
That's right.
And the high school associated with you also has this cell phone ban.
At one of their schools.
At one of the schools. Yeah. What happens when the kids go to high school?
And they go to a school that doesn't have the ban.
Mm-hmm.
They cheer. Hooray!
They're happy.
Because I think when we speak to our teenagers, they don't want the ban. They want to be able to decide. And I think, obviously, we talk to our teenagers. We want to hear from them. And we want to find ways to give them more agency throughout the day. But it's not just about their phones. It's agency about what they're learning. It's agency about what they want to do with their future. The phone, it's either a tool for learning or it's a distraction from learning. That's how we incorporated into what we do at the school.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is State of the Bay on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW Bay Area. I'm your host, Grace Wan. We're discussing whether students should have access to cell phones while they're in school, and we're joined by high school teacher and parent Max Garone, who's on the Leadership Council of the San Francisco Parent Coalition. And we also have San Mateo Superintendent of the K-8 School District, Diego Ochoa, who's here to talk about what his school district has done, which is to ban cell phones. And we want to hear from you. How does your school handle smartphones? And parents, how do you think cell phones are affecting your child's mental and academic health? And students, do you think there's a place for cell phones at school? You can join us by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255, or email us at stateofthebay@kalw.org. We have a comment from Rick from Citrus Heights who writes, I feel during class time, cell phones should not be used. I know someone whose son was caught during class looking at Instagram. He was grounded for a long time. And recess should be a time for playing sports. You know, Max, as a teacher, and Diego was talking about how teenagers want to have agency. Have you found a way to give your students agency while balancing what is essentially a quite addictive thing, their cell phones?
I think that it's really a teacher-by-teacher thing in our district especially. The teachers that are establish the best structure in class manage to do that. But any other teacher that doesn't or can't manage their classroom that way, they're going to get steamrolled one way or another. And teachers talk about it all the time. It's the topic of discussion. And you see students, they know what they're doing. They can understand one teacher has one standard, another teacher has another standard. So they are always looking to use this as a way out. It's a pity because this is one of the fundamental aspects of our society right now, and it's a wonderful tool. We can read whatever we want on it. We can play games. We can communicate with family. But this is a place of learning, and to establish a structure for that is almost impossible with these devices there because they're designed to do other things as well.
What's some middle ground strategies, though, like in the classroom that you've seen teachers use successfully?
Well, I've seen a lot of teachers, they can bring in lock boxes of a type, not a safe, but a place where you can plug in your phone to repower it. And that's an incentive for a lot of students because they're always running out of power because they're always on their phone. And other teachers are just, they establish such a strong discipline in the class that students know that they cannot do that. But it is, they're constantly tested, and that's part of teaching, is establishing that structure of expectations. So most other teachers find some middle ground or, you know, will let a certain amount of things happen or not know something is happening until it's too late. And so then it's always this constant battle or struggle to reestablish that structure or to allow something to happen while not letting it all get out of hand.
Well, let's take a listen to another student's opinion. We've got Gwen here who left a message for us.
Hi, I'm Gwen. I just graduated 8th grade. I think the best policy for phones at schools would probably be like putting them in some sort of pocket in each class or just leaving them in your locker. Having your phone at school, though, like it can help with schoolwork. It's like an easy calculator. It's easy to look up things. It's also nice to have like during breaks, like lunch, so that you can like make videos and like hang out with your friends and have your phone with you. I feel like overall, though, like having a phone at school is not a good idea. I think it interrupts lessons, distracts kids, and like causes them to lose interest in school topics that could actually be really interesting.
So, I mean, I think Gwen there is identifying two things, like a phone can be good, but it can also be distracting. And Diego, what's your response to that? I mean, I know that you've banned phones at your schools, but is there a use for phones in schools? I mean, Gwen's identified, you know, a calculator, a place to look up Wikipedia, you know.
I think it is, but we also, as a school district, we provide every student with a device one-to-one. So they show up to school, and we have chargers in every classroom. And those devices meet the needs that every child has in our district. And when we put this policy into place and wanted to create this change, it was really less about taking away something from the kids, and it was more about addressing something that we knew was happening, where, you know, when we went to school, we were probably all pretty low tech. You know, whatever technology we had wasn't that advanced. And, you know, kids get bullied and kids have interactions with each other that aren't very positive. And you might hear about it at the end of the day. You might hear about it, you know, after school type of thing. What we were seeing was teenagers having conflict with one another and instantaneously the entire school knowing about it because of Snapchat and these different programs that I think, as you pointed out, they're addictive and they're designed to get that kind of reaction going. So you have a kid who had an argument with another kid, and maybe somebody called him a really horrible name, and now the whole school knows that they got called that horrible name. I mean, we saw many, many cases of depression, many, many cases of severe anxiety. And we tracked that data, and we're just seeing huge decreases in the number of kids who report being bullied online and in depression and anxiety in the district. And we feel really good about that.
Just because the devices are banned in the school during the school day.
That is one of the main reasons. We have increased counseling support services, and we have a wonderful team of people at every middle school that devotes themselves to support students. But the cell phone policy is absolutely a big part of that change.
I wonder, I mean, this idea that you have devices that you're giving the kids. I mean, is that a tablet or a
computer? It's a Chromebook. Yeah, it's a Chromebook laptop.
I mean, so, I mean, they are getting access to a screen per se. I mean, so is the difference that Chromebook doesn't have social media on it?
Yes.
And that's the thing.
And it's a tool. The teacher obviously has, you know, the ability to say, let's take out our Chromebooks and work on them versus a cell phone. I can surreptitiously hold it under my desk. And most of the teenagers do that. They don't necessarily outright hold their phone up in your face and show you that they're watching Netflix. But these phones are actually their televisions and their boomboxes. And they do more than just text and call. I mean, they're really, really powerful devices. And these Chromebooks, we image them and we set them up. So we take certain permissions away and we limit things that the Chromebooks can do while leaving the functionality from an educational standpoint.
Max, could you see that something like that happening in the San Francisco School District? I mean, San Mateo has a little bit of a different demographic. You know, can San Francisco schools afford these Yonder bags and offering, you know, one-to-one Chromebooks for the kids?
It's already been tried in some places. My daughter went to a middle school here locally. They use the Yonder system. It seemed to be a very positive thing for the entire school and her peers. We have the same system as the superintendent was describing, where every student has a Chromebook that's assigned to them, and those Chromebooks are limited in abilities. We as teachers can run a variety of programs to have the entire class learn the same thing or use them as learning devices. So the structure's all there. It is, financing is an issue. The pouches cost $25 to $35 a piece, so it is an expenditure, but the learning gain and the social gain is just remarkable to me. Having seen it in middle school already in my daughter's education, I would really love to see that everywhere. Because I hear about it from other parents in the parent community. I hear about it from students. They are really bemoaning this effect, and even if they don't know it consciously, they will signal that. And then teachers, of course, are just besides themselves about this. So it's,
I feel like someone should get in touch with the Yonder people and say, this is a whole market.
I think they're on it.
They should be, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it shouldn't cost as much as it costs Chris Rock to have these at his concerts.
When we asked our teenagers, what's the one thing you've noticed that's different since we changed this policy? We survey them every year. The most frequently responded comment was, kids pay more attention in class.
Oh, is that music to your ears?
So ask any superintendent, any school board in California, what would you pay to have teenagers pay more? What would the value, the dollar value be? So that's how I look at it, is if it translates into learning, then we budget for it. We make cuts elsewhere and we budget for it. Because it's really not about the authority or the power of saying, I took something away from teenagers. It's we really need them to learn things. So, you know, what our teachers are teaching has a high value for us, and we invest in that.
Well, let's hear from another student. This is a rising senior who, you know, is a little bit older and has a slightly different take.
I think that they should be allowed in hallways and at lunch. And I also think that for people who are shy or have struggles making friends, it can be a good comfort to them that they don't have to sit there and stare at nothing. Because I don't know if taking away a truly introverted person's phone will actually encourage them enough to go and talk to others. But I do agree that it should not be allowed in class. I think that teachers who tell kids to put them away, they always take them out. And I think if teachers try to incorporate them into the curriculum, they're used for other purposes. And again, cheating becomes easier and it becomes more tempting when it's so easily accessible. So I think all in all, I believe that it should not be allowed in class. It should be able to be used outside of classrooms and at lunch.
Well, what about Molly's suggestion, Superintendent Ochoa? Do you think they should be allowed at lunch?
No.
Why?
Well, a couple of reasons. One is when the student takes it out for that reason during that time, those are times where as a school you want students to be able to interact with each other. And what we have seen over and over again as these software programs have just become more and more prevalent is the kids are all basically staring down at their phones. It was sort of like the visit I told you about at San Mateo High, where we just saw teenagers talking to each other. And that difference, that changed the whole culture of the school, where you saw just real engagement between teenagers. And we said that's really something we want. So I think I understand the idea that a teenager has of, I'm not in class, so I would like to use my phone. And what we try to do is we try to create more opportunities during lunch and break for teenagers to interact with each other. And sometimes those breaks for introverts, they're really nice, quiet times. Those introverts, sometimes they want to just be able to relax for 15 minutes and not be part of a class of 30 kids learning, you know, the subject that they're in. So I think it accomplishes both.
Well, Max, I want to ask you a question that's come up. There are a lot of parents who want to be connected to their kids while their kids are at school. And, you know, there is an issue that people feel about the safety in schools. As, you know, we see a lot of school shootings in the news, sadly, and their parents who just want to be able to access their kids. What do you say to that parent about a policy like this?
Well, two things. So in a normal everyday school life, we have an entire staff that's ready to accept messages from parents, pass them along, bring a kid down for an appointment, whatever it is. We have a staff that is perfectly capable of doing that. And then in the emergency case, which is a true edge case, but one that I've been in the lockdown with kids in the room, and you know, it is not the best place in the world for kids to have cell phones because we don't want people making calls, making themselves obvious. If there is a true emergency, that's the last thing that we need. We all need to be paying attention to the safety procedures at the school. I, as a teacher, need to be leading those students to do what is necessary at the moment. And they need to be paying attention to me instead of calling or looking at something else, you know, being distracted again. And I realize as a parent, it's a very difficult situation. You can imagine very different things about this, especially given what we've seen at other schools. But we are all trained to deal with a certain situation, and our schools are set up to deal with them. And if we can do our jobs, then we should ideally be able to live a better life.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, there is a new bill. It's called AB 3216, and it would require school districts in California to adopt a policy to limit or prohibit the use of cell phones while students are at a school site. Superintendent, does it go far enough?
I think it does. I think when you want to make change at such a high level, you're talking about across the state of California, you have to give these school districts some space to operate. I think it's an important conversation for every school community to be having. And it would allow school districts like San Francisco Unified, San Mateo Foster City School District, to do what they feel is right for them. But I also feel that as educators, supporting bills that truly try to do something good for kids is part of a responsibility that we have.
Mm-hmm. What would you like to see in that bill, Max? Anything more?
Of course, it would be nice to have the financing to do mm-hmm. this, because we're all dealing with budgets right now. But the as the superintendent was saying, this sort of leadership at a state level is fantastic because it helps provide guidance for everybody else. And as a parent advocate, it really gives me the ability to go to the district and say, hey, you know, there is somebody else besides us advocating for this. And in fact, it's your job to do something different. And it's not like I don't think many people are very resistant to this, actually. I think it is we're moving in a similar direction, and this is reflecting a greater cultural conversation and guiding that along.
I can see an instance in which a school district might say, great policy. This is exactly what we want to have. Teachers, we'd like you to do this, but we're not giving you any of the technology. There are no Yonder bags. There's no Chromebook. You teachers need to enforce this. What happens then, Max?
I don't think much changes, and that's the problem, that it really does require the financing and the structure. You know, as the superintendent was saying, his district, everybody has Chromebooks. Our district, everybody has Chromebooks. This is the foundation for learning in the digital age, and we need that across the state and across the country, but we also need the financing to make that happen and make these other aspects of it happening. Yes, if we can find the money, or if we can find the leadership to find the money, then it'll all work. But if we don't have that, then we're going to be in the same situation.
Yeah, and there's no financing attached to this bill, right?
No.
Yeah.
It's missing. And the truth is, when a district takes that step to say we want to enforce a policy that's going to get kids off their phones and get them paying attention more in class, reduce anxiety, reduce depression, reduce bullying. I mean, you know, these are like really powerful things to think about. And at the same time, we have to take the part that we have of analyzing our own budgets and thinking about where to best put our dollars. As a state, when you have the California Department of Education and the legislature and our governor, you know, campaigning and doing a lot of work on bullying and depression and social-emotional wellness, I think listen to your educators who are implementing these policies, because these policies are making a positive impact.
Diego, I think they need to have you on the front line of this.
I'm ready.
I'm convinced.
I'm ready.
We have one email from a listener who says, ban or no ban, the single most important thing we should all do is to help kids learn healthy digital habits. Even smartphone bans or stringent school policies should be accompanied with learning about digital citizenship and proper phone etiquette. This will serve them well, not just in school, but for the rest of their lives. Do you agree with that, Diego?
Yeah, and when we spoke to our teenagers and asked them what they would change about the policy and what they would change about the process, because we made the decision really fast. Like in 60 days, we went from not having a policy to adopting it and getting these pouches for everybody. And our teenagers told us, you didn't listen to us enough. You didn't ask us what we thought about this.
Mm.
And that really sat with me for a long time. It really bothered me.
Mm-hmm.
So we spend time every year bringing kids together and asking them, what would make this policy more effective for you? What can we do to show you some respect and show mm-hmm. you some access and some agency with the policy, so that you really have a stake in it as well? So you really understand why we're doing it. Because the average kid just thinks, they took my phone away.
Yeah, right.
They didn't hear the rationale for it.
Yeah.
And that really is an important part of the process.
Mm. Can I ask, since this ban's been in place in your school district, has it changed your own relationship with your phone?
Yes, because when you're at a school that has this policy in place, the minute you step onto the campus, it changes your relationship to how you use technology. So even visiting middle schools, you're more cognizant of, let me go and interact with these kids one-on-one and talk to staff and talk to parents on those campuses, because the change is noticeable among everybody. And you mentioned it earlier. There is a lot of parent energy around stopping these kind of policies because so many parents are addicted to contacting their kids during the day. The 15, 20 text messages and calls a day, they're very intrusive to what the child is doing at school. And we have to own that. We have to talk about that because, as you know, we have a lot of we're married to some of these people and we're related to some of these people. They're on their phones
a lot. We might be some of those people.
Maybe even
in this room. You know, well, this has been such a good and interesting conversation, and I want to thank you both for joining us today here at State of the Bay. We've been talking about banning cell phones in classrooms. There is a bill that is on the legislature's table to think about doing that statewide. Thanks for joining us, Max Garone.
Thank you.
And thank you for joining us, Superintendent Diego Ochoa.
My pleasure.
Coming up after this break, my co-host Ethan Elkind talks about a new magazine, Dreams I Dreamt, Letters to San Francisco. Stay tuned.
Tune into Cross Currents tomorrow morning at 11. We'll hear about a secret venue hiding near Jack London Square.
It's pretty cool, too, because I feel like people reach out and I get to be like, do I want a concert of this, like, in my downstairs? Like, yeah, I do. Yeah, I think I do.
It's Oakland's secret. That's tomorrow morning at 11 on Cross Currents from KALW News.
A new San Francisco literary magazine has hit the shelves. Dreams I Dreamt, Letters to San Francisco, is a collection of stories about our fair city by an impressive variety of local writers, like Andrew Sean Greer, Carol Queen, and Gary Camilla, as well as one of our guests tonight, Stuart Shuffman. Stuart not only contributed to the collection, but published it with support from the Civic Joy Fund. Welcome to State of the Bay, Stuart.
How you doing? Thanks for having me.
Glad you can join us. And we also have one of the editors of Dreams I Dreamt, Oscar Villalone. Oscar is also the editor at San Francisco literary magazine Ziziva, if I said that correctly, and the former book editor at the San Francisco Chronicle. So welcome to the program too, Oscar.
Thank you for having me.
So first of all, congratulations, gentlemen, on the publication of Dreams I Dreamt, Letters to San Francisco. It's really an excellent reminder of all that there is to love about San Francisco. And Stuart, I wanted to start with you and just ask how this new collection came about.
Yeah, so I was talking to Manny Yucatil from the Civic Joy Fund, also Manny's Cafe. And I, you know, and the Civic Joy Fund's given all this money to various really deserving people. They paid drag queens to do drag. They paid muralists to make murals. They paid musicians to do music on the streets. But they haven't done anything with writers yet. And we have such a wonderful, deep literary tradition here in San Francisco. And so I pitched the idea and he thought it was great and I got the ball rolling. And then I reached out to Charlie Jane Anders and Oscar, who co-edited this, because I know what my strengths are and being an editor is not one of them. And so I handed the ball to them and they just knocked this out of the park.
Well, I also want to ask for your thoughts on this, because this idea of the San Francisco doom loop, this narrative has become a real thing that the national press has picked up on. And I'm just curious how this narrative really got started.
Oh, I have plenty to say on this. So downtown San Francisco was built for 1907, right? It wasn't built for 2024. And so what happened after COVID was that people didn't want to go back to work in offices because they didn't want to put on pants, and that's cool. But what happened downtown was going to happen anyways, because the nature of cities has changed, the nature of work has changed, right? And so the pandemic was just a catalyst to speed things up. This would have happened anyways, and it's also happening all over the world. The difference is that we're San Francisco, so people like to beat us up because we're awesome, and we scare them because we're constantly pushing the boundary and pushing the envelope. But look, this was going to happen, and it's just happening quicker than it would have. But this is, once again, San Francisco. We are a boom and bust town. We're just in a bust right now. And we will boom again because that's just how we roll.
Well, and your collection really helps bring a lot of these themes out, not just of the doom loop, but just of the amazingness of San Francisco and a lot of those moments of joy and the individual stories. And Oscar, as the editor, how did you go about gathering up the writers for this collection?
Well, talking to Charlie Jean Anders, we basically asked some folks that we knew and proposed to them, would you mind sending us something? on the idea of why you love San Francisco. Something that recognizes our problems, but also to point out that the only reason why we are so passionate about what's going on in the cities is because we love it. So why do you love it?
And Oscar, I noticed in some of these pieces, perhaps many of them, there's a bit of a tension, almost like an artist versus tech bro kind of dynamic. And I'm wondering if you want to comment on that.
It's not we don't like tech bros. No, I think it's important for us to understand we're all in this together and that space has to be made for as many people as possible. We do not come into this world in a vacuum. There was a history before you showed up. You're appearing in the middle of a long show. There are many, many episodes before you got here. It behooves you to catch up on those episodes and see where you fit in. It does not start with you. You are not season one, right? It's a city. Look around you. It was not custom built for anyone.
Absolutely. You know, well, especially when you think about San Francisco being a city of a lot of new arrivals, a lot of folks coming here for economic opportunities and maybe haven't been here long or may not stay too long. Stuart, let me turn to you because many of the pieces talk about the freedom that we have in San Francisco to be whoever we are or want or hope to be. And do you think that freedom is still alive and well, at least compared to other cities across the country? Or do we still have that sense here in San Francisco?
Yeah, absolutely we do. I mean, I think you can be anything you want in San Francisco, but a Republican, you know? it is here. And because the economics of the world now, I don't think you'll have the next Grateful Dead coming out of San Francisco again or the next Dead Kennedys, because to have a young theme like that, you have to have more affordable housing. And we are just really not doing that well, unfortunately. You need affordable housing for people to have the space and time to create. Hopefully, things will change.
Well, Stuart, I know you contributed a piece for the collection titled It's Foggest in San Francisco. And I'm wondering if you would be so kind as to read that piece for us.
Totally. All right. It's foggest in San Francisco. It's foggest here in San Francisco. Our great gray dame can be seen sashaying through the Mission, peering sadly into the husks of burnt buildings, leaning gently against them. The downtown skyscrapers, those monuments to industry and wealth, look as if the sky got tired of being scraped and decided to smother them. The Sunset and the Richmond have been lost altogether, and the search party says they won't be found again until September. If it's foggest, it must have been foggest when the person who is not Mark Twain made that famous Twainian remark about the coldest winter being a summer in San Francisco. That person must have been relatively new to San Francisco because there's a hint of incredulousness there. Newbies view our foggy summers as something they have to unfortunately endure. Those of us who've given ourselves completely to the city view this as the time we feel most at home. I was in Lake Tahoe last weekend doing things you can't do in San Francisco, like breathe in fresh pine air or swim in temperate water or wear shorts. It was in the 80s each day and people basked in the sun while lying on the beach. It was nice to see what summer felt like to the rest of the world. Driving back through the Central Valley, the temperature reached as high as 110 degrees, an ugly number that would have made the entirety of San Francisco melt like wax. Then crossing over the Emperor Norton Bridge, there's the city, like someone passed out peacefully on the couch, the fog draped across it. I sighed with love as the temperature tumbled down to foggiest numbers. It's always wonderful to come home, and I look silly in shorts anyways. It was the fog that shrouded the Golden Gate from Sir Francis Drake when he sailed up the coast. He had no idea what kind of magnificence he passed by on the way north. The fog hid the entire bay from him, and in a way, that's what foggiest does to those who can't wait around for September. Nobody appreciates nice weather like San Franciscans. We may feel most at home during our cold and foggy summers, but come September, when the weather gets hot, the city springs to life all Twitter-pated and ready to mingle. By that time, the tourists have mostly gone home, and every weekend has some sort of decadent splendor. Folsom Street Fair, Harley Strictly Bluegrass, Fleet Week, all of it hitting a crescendo with Halloween before it peters out into our, hopefully, rainy months. But right now it's foggiest, and the best way to honor that is to do what San Franciscans have been doing for a century and a half. Walk through the evening, arm in arm with someone you might be in love with, and use their scarf to pull them in closer while you lean in for a kiss. Or sit in a dark bar, occasionally looking out the window while you scribble poetry about the one who got away. Or stay up late on a rooftop with new friends, drinking whiskey and telling stories. Or stay in early, reading a book about all the places you've yet to see. Foggiest is romance thrown into the atmosphere. That's when you feel like you're too busy or too old or too jaded to feel romantic about anything ever again. Step outside and realize that at least you'll always have foggiest. the end.
Well, I love that piece, Stuart. It just wonderfully captures such a unique feature of San Francisco in addition to the natural beauty, this crazy weather patterns that we have and what that does to us culturally and otherwise. So thank you for reading that. It's a wonderful gift. And Oscar Villallon, an editor of the collection, and Stuart Schuffman, also known as Broke Ass Stuart, publisher of Dreams I Dreamt, Letters to San Francisco. Thank you both so much for coming on State of the Bay and for sharing this gift with our listeners and with the people of San Francisco.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
And if you'd like a copy of Dreams I Dreamt, we'll make sure to have a link on our website, stateofthebay@kalw.org.
Well, that's State of the Bay this week. We hope you'll join us next Monday when the San Francisco Unified School District Superintendent, Dr. Matt Wayne, is going to be on. He's going to be talking about budget cuts and curriculums in San Francisco public schools. Get your fingers on the phone dial to give him a call. If you have any questions about State of the Bay, give us an email at stateofthebay@kalw.org. Tonight's show is produced by Jillian Emblad and Ann Harper. It was engineered by David Kwan, and Damian Miner was our board operator. I'm Grace Wan. Good night, and thanks for listening.